Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber. As I mentioned last time, with this week's episode, we'll be switching gears slightly with a podcast format. While I've been introducing you to various aspects of critical thinking over the last several weeks, such as how to deal with bias, Aristotle's modes of persuasion, argumentation, rhetorical devices, and the like, I'm planning to start each show between now and the election by applying those critical thinking elements to a specific aspect of the political campaign. This will give you some concrete examples that demonstrate the principles you've been learning, as well as providing me the opportunity to expand on subjects such as figures of speech or fallacies as the candidates indulge us with more and more examples of each. Also, during each podcast between now and Election Day, we'll be joined by a different guest who specializes in some aspect of critical thinking research or education who can provide us insights into their own work as well as on the presidential election campaign. And my first guest, I'm thrilled to say, is the Critical Thinker Academy's Kevin DeLaplante. Ken will be joining us in a few minutes, but before then I want to talk about the most recent election artifact the candidates were thoughtful enough to provide us to study, the first presidential debate. If you followed commentary in the days leading up to the debate, you'll have likely encountered general criticisms of debates that perennially crop up during a presidential race, notably complaints such as, why don't the candidates ever engage one another, or why do they go on so long rather than give a straight answer to a straight question? I'm hoping that longtime listeners who heard those criticisms responded with a knowing smile, at least to yourselves. For as was discussed in the podcast and argumentation, the reason the candidates don't seem to be bothering to try to convince one another is that they aren't. Their real audience, after all, is not the opposing candidate, but the people at home watching the debate on television and the media covering the story. For the audience of the unseen public, each candidate is presenting logos-based arguments that they hope will convince voters to support their positions, while also adding pathos and ethos-based appeals to try to build intangibles, such as what media commentators have taken to call likability and authenticity. And for the media audience, each candidate is trying to give a performance that will be reported as them having won the debate, a message supported by armies of spin doctors ready to explain why one candidate or the other was victorious to any reporter willing to take their phone calls. For long after the specifics of the debate are forgotten, the impression of who won and who lost, who gained momentum and who lost it, is what will persist in people's memories. And as for why the candidates tend to give mini speeches instead of responding to questions from the moderator or challenges from their opponent, remember back when we talked about how an argument is organized into specific components, starting with an ethos-based introduction, followed by logos-based elements such as statement of facts, division, and logical proof. Only after you get through this material do you get to the refutation, a response to a question or challenge, followed, at least in the speech, with an emotional climax or peroration. So the tendency of candidates to speechify before responding is just an example of their instinctively gravitating towards the structures defined by the canons of rhetoric, even when they're required to fit that rhetoric into the restricted format of a debate. Given this context, the format used during the first debate was extremely interesting, for it seemed to have been created in response to the public's desire to see the candidates actually mix it up with one another, even if they had to be forced into doing so. For those who didn't watch it, the debate was broken into 6 15-minute segments, each focusing on a single domestic issue. And during each segment, each candidate was given just 2 minutes to state their case, with the rest of the time dedicated to an enforced set of exchanges between the candidates, where they were required to contrast their position with those of their opponent and respond directly to one another's statements. As usual, the moderator of the debate, in this case Jim Lehrer from PBS's NewsHour, had very little control over the behavior of the strong-willed candidates. But the structure that Romney and Obama were required to work under did limit their ability to completely ignore one another, preventing this event from turning into the usual joint press conference masquerading as debate. Rather than discuss who won or who lost within this framework, I prefer to talk about how the structure played to the strengths and weaknesses of each candidate. President Obama has been hailed for his masterful political oratory, particularly before large audiences. But having spent time analyzing several of his speeches using the argumentation tools we've been discussing here and on the blog, I've come to realize that he's extremely good at certain persuasive techniques, such as the use of rhetorical devices and his ability to move audiences with extremely powerful pathos-based perorations, that is, the climactic conclusions of his speeches. In fact, he's so good at using figures of speech, as well as interjecting pathos and ethos-based appeals throughout his presentations, that he often uses these as a substitute for some of the logical components you would expect to find in formal political communication. Now, no politician can possibly be perfect in each and every aspect of oratory, but in the case of the first presidential debate, Obama's reliance on pathos and ethos made him vulnerable in a format that required short, to-the-point responses built primarily on logos. So when he should have been crisply quoting convincing facts and figures to support his policies, something former President Bill Clinton was complimented for doing quite well at the recent Democratic convention, he instead reached for pathos-laden anecdotes, such as stories about his grandmother or about suffering voters he talked to during the campaign, a few too many times when logos-based argumentation was required. Romney also overused stories of voters hugging him during this or that campaign event and pleading with him to win and enact his policies. And given that, in contrast to Obama, pathos-based emotional appeals are not Romney's strength, he should have also limited his use of such devices more than he did. However, the CEO mentality that causes him to lunge for logos, even in public speeches where he'd be better off pulling heartstrings, was actually an advantage for Romney within the debate format we just discussed. And the dangers of him coming across as everyone's nightmare of a hectoring boss was ameliorated by his skillful use of ethos-based appeals. If you remember back during the podcast covering logos, pathos, and ethos, I mentioned that Romney would face challenges convincing voters that he was one of them, given that the archetype he most resembles is that of a corporate executive, which most of the public is not. But I also noted that he might be able to get around this problem by appealing to shared American values, at least the ones we like to think of ourselves as possessing, such as patriotism, self-reliance, and thrift. Which is why I thought the best rhetorical moment of the night was Romney's weaving lines from the Constitution and Bill of Rights into his response to a question on the role of government. No doubt this was a rehearsed and polished set piece posing as the answer to a question, but this did not detract from his effectiveness, although it was blunted when he immediately followed these statements by returning to criticizing his opponent on less lofty matters, possibly demonstrating the Republican candidate's inability to quit while he was ahead. Because the debate format does not leave room for some of the linguistic rhetorical flourishes that work well in the stump, each candidate turned instead to strategic rhetorical devices to blunt the harshest criticism they met from their opponent. In Romney's case, he used humor to limit the effectiveness of one of Obama's key talking points, the one that said Romney's economic plan would add $7 trillion to the deficit, by comparing it to the behavior of Romney's sons, who he claimed also repeated fabrications over and over in hope that they would ultimately be believed. You'll notice that this rhetorical device provided no substantial rebuttal to the accusation, although Romney did provide a factual rebuttal elsewhere in his responses, but it served the purpose of placing the president in a lose-lose situation of either continuing to repeat the same charges and being immediately associated with petulant misbehaving children, or keeping his mouth shut on the subject, as his Republican rival wanted him to do. For his part, the president made use of innuendo, pointing out not once but twice that Romney's plans were intentionally short on detail, leveraging the truism that you don't hide good news to imply that his opponent was hiding the downside of his plans from the public. And given that Romney has the difficult task of selling as relatively pain-free an economic plan that is certain to involve budget cuts and other sacrifices, we're likely to see this line of attack expand in the coming weeks by Obama and his surrogates, and not necessarily in the form of subtle innuendo. In the blog last week, I highlighted some mathematical figures worth checking in each candidate's statements. And while I didn't notice quite as many mathematical fallacies as I thought I would hear, both candidates did fall back on argumentation from authority a number of times. This is actually one of those fallacies we've not covered yet, but it's basically the attempt to say, hey, don't take my word on the subject, experts have endorsed me, or the XYZ report confirms my opponent's plan will cost jobs, or the XYZ report my opponent cites is contradicted by not one, but six reports that say otherwise. Not that such experts and reports don't exist, but their existence is not being presented to prove a point. Rather, they are being used to impress you and lend weight to a candidate's argument, with hope that you won't have the time or inclination to do your own research and make up your own mind on the matter. And before you panic, we actually don't have time right now to look up this information ourselves, although feel free to do so on your own if you like, hopefully by following the principles of information literacy we've reviewed during the last couple of podcasts. But now, it's time for me to hand the mic over to our first guest on the Critical Voter podcast. By now, I expect most of you are familiar with Kevin DeLaPlante and his Critical Thinker Academy, which have been featured many times on this podcast and at the www.criticalvoter.com website. Now, I need to warn you, this is the first time either Kevin or I have done a Skype-based podcast interview, so I'm going to ask you to be forgiving with regard to any technical snafus that might occur. Can you hear me, Kevin?
I can hear you.
Okay, all systems seem to be go. So, Kevin DeLaPlante, welcome to Critical Voter. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to create the Critical Thinker Academy?
Sure, okay, thanks. So in terms of my background, my undergrad degree was in physics, and I went on to grad school in philosophy at the University of Western Ontario. And I studied there the philosophy of science. And then when I got my first academic job, well, I guess this was my second academic job here at Iowa State University back in 99, I was teaching courses in philosophy of science. And I taught a course called Introduction to Logic and Scientific Reasoning. So that was basically our department's critical thinking course. So over the past 12, 13 years of teaching that course, I gradually became more interested in the sort of conceptual foundations of critical thinking and argumentation. Came to believe that it was arguably the most important course I was teaching because it had the broadest usage and importance in terms of the average student. And so I started developing these video tutorial resources for my courses that I would use to sort of offload lectures. Like if I'm teaching a course in the philosophy of science and I want my students to be familiar with the basic definition of an argument, then I could refer them to these tutorials that would be on like a WebCT page or a Blackboard page. And that would free up some time in class to do content. And I could sort of offload that background material. And then my students were telling me that this stuff was really important and that I should make it more widely available. And so I started thinking about this, and then it plugged into the vision I had when I first started, actually, as a grad student, because my basic motivation for getting into academia was primarily educational. It really wasn't to be sort of the top article writer in my field where I write these high-level articles that only five people in the world can understand. I was interested in education. I was interested in learning things that were intellectually interesting to me and sharing them with as broad an audience as I could. And so I always envisioned myself as aiming towards education for a general audience. So that was the main incentive for producing these materials, making them available on the web and so forth.
Those materials have been very helpful to me as I put together this podcast, especially ones where you introduced me to subjects such as cognitive biases. Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose to create lessons on certain topics and what those choices mean with regard to how you define critical thinking?
Sure. You know, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I get asked it a lot. And so I've been revisiting this over and over again. In some ways, the Academy and my podcast is an exercise in me trying to figure out the answer to this question. And it's been revised over the months and years now. But I think the short version of what I think critical thinking is all about is that it's an effort to improve the quality of one's judgments and the quality of one's actions by seeking out and being responsive to reasons. I also think that critical thinking is a kind of educational ideal in that when you see it in its full bloom, it can function as a norm for what any sort of educational endeavor ought to be aiming for. That's something that's more than just a purely instrumental training in how to perform some task. Now, the longer answer to this is that I think of critical thinking as multidimensional. It has these parts to it. And in the podcast and on the site, I've been talking about five things in the past. I think now I have to move it up to six. So there are like six pillars that I think are essential for critical thinking. And in order, they go like this for me. They go logic, argumentation, rhetoric, background knowledge, creativity, and character. So for logic, that's like the science of what follows from what. That's the discipline that says, given these assumptions, what does and doesn't follow from those? And there's a formal logic, and then there's a logic associated with reasoning with risk and uncertainty as well. So there's lots of branches of that, but it's generally not concerned with the truth or the plausibility of the premises themselves. When you move to argumentation, you're dealing with arguments as a whole, and the primary focal question in argumentation theory is what counts as a good argument. The distinction between good and bad argumentation, which becomes the distinction between good and bad reasons for belief or good and bad reasons for action. So that's a fundamentally a normative project, the distinction between good and bad reasons. And so that field would include the theories of fallacies, for example, but also the criteria for what's a good causal argument? What's a good argument from analogy? What's a good argument that generalizes from particular cases to the general case? There are standards for what counts for when those inferences are strong, for example. And that's all part of our argumentation theory. Now, this third component, rhetoric, which you've talked about a lot on your podcast, way more than I have. Rhetoric, if we think of it as the slogan, is the art of persuasive speech, then the distinction between rhetoric in its pure form and argumentation would be that both of these have their goal, which is to persuade. But argumentation is specifically about persuasion for good reasons, whereas rhetoric is this broader project of persuasive discourse. Now, why is that important for critical thinking? Well, you've talked about it a lot, but I'll just reinforce the point that you've made is that good arguments are made good by attending to the rhetorical dimensions of communication. You cannot separate out the rhetorical dimensions of an argument from the sort of logical, analytical elements of it. And that's, I think, a fact that's not appreciated well enough in a lot of the critical thinking textbooks that are out there, especially the ones written by philosophers that have a sort of logic and informal logic emphasis to them. So this fourth bin is background knowledge, and you stated it well on your podcast as well, that no amount of logic can make up for ignorance about the subject matter. the fifth element now that I've added to my list of components is creativity, because I realize now that it's a fundamental skill. It's essential for problem solving in a lot of contexts where it's not just a matter of knowing what follows from what, but if you're actually trying to solve a problem that's difficult, that's challenging, there's a dilemma involved in being able to imagine alternative possibilities. Expanding the horizons of what's possible is a fundamental skill. So finally, this last item is character. And we need to add something about character because the previous list of things has to do with skills, really. It has to do with your ability to analyze arguments, to assess statements, to persuade, and so on. But if a person doesn't have the natural disposition to do this, I mean, it's one thing to be able to do it. It's another thing to want to do it. It's another thing to be disposed to do it, to be habitually disposed in a way that you are naturally inclined to seek out evidence, to ask for reasons, to look for fallacies, to pursue the virtues of intellectual honesty. Those are attributes of character and not just skills. And so a critical thinker is also someone who has to care about the value of critical thinking.
It's an interesting evolution of your thinking, and I look forward to seeing where you go with those new creativity and character pillars. But given where you are, in this case, I mean Iowa, a state which has had to deal with the presidential campaign far longer than anywhere else, I wonder what your thoughts were regarding the subject of this show, which is how critical thinking can apply to the U.S. election.
Well, striking thing about being in Iowa is the political ads, I suppose, on TV. The thing I think I have to say about this is an observation I made when I'm teaching critical thinking during a political season, and it's that students can get really cynical about, even more cynical than they might otherwise be inclined to be. Learning about standards of good argumentation and fallacies, and turn on a TV ad or you turn on a political debate and you see the candidates that seem to be guilty of every fallacy under the book, it leads people to believe that political speech is pathological. It makes them cynical, it makes them dismissive, that politics is fundamentally this intellectually and morally bankrupt enterprise. It's pure rhetoric in its basest form, right? So I get this response from students because we're looking for case studies, examples of bad reads, and then they show up on TV and they show up in debates. My response to this is that I guess I'm sympathetic, but also I think there's a mistake being made. And I think that there's a risk involved in thinking about critical thinking too much from the standpoint of a narrowly conceived view of logic, informal logic, and fallacy theory, because then it kind of distorts what it is that you're looking at when you look at political discourse. And to properly understand like the rhetorical context in which political speech is being delivered, there are different norms of successful discourse in different contexts. So just to give an example, like if you're a trial lawyer and you are advocating on behalf of your client, the discourse there is such that we want our lawyers to be advocating for clients. And that means that they're not supposed to be weighing the evidence impartially and providing the jury with a balanced view of all of the evidence, nor would we expect them to, say, publicly concede the point of the opposing lawyer. It's not their job to do that. The point of the adversarial system in the courts is that it's a one-sided discourse, right, where you're advocating one side, and then the jury's job is to figure out the truth from all of that under the instructions of a judge. And so the standards of what counts as the norms of good argumentation or good persuasion under that case are quite different from the norms that you would learn in the idealized context of argumentation theory, where when in the context of studying fallacies, for example, you're imagining yourself or another person both committed to the pursuit of truth, both being responsive to reasons, both not wanting to persuade on the basis of lies or on the basis of distortion or emotional appeals. And this idealized context is where these norms of rational argumentation come from. But in the real world, you have all these different varying political contexts. And so when I see a political ad or a debate, what I tell the students is, don't bother trying to identify all the logical fallacies. That's to miss the point entirely. This isn't a case where they're actually giving arguments. That is, it's not argumentation in the normal sense of the word. It's an instance of political discourse that's intended to be persuasive, but you got to ask yourself, what's the intended target audience of this speech? Who are they trying to persuade? What would count as successful persuasion in this context? And clearly, of course, they're not going to try to persuade each other. When you have Obama and Romney on the stand, they would freak out if one of them conceded the point that one was making. And rightly so, they would be crazy to do that, right? all of a sudden, the norm of responsiveness to reasons seems like they're not following that norm, right? Because they would never give up on a point in the face of even compelling reasons in public like that. But also, it's naive to expect them to, right? It's more helpful, I think, from a critical thinking standpoint, to imagine what is the critical thinking context here. That is, who are they trying to persuade? It's undecided voters. It's voters within swing states. It's also not trying to embarrass themselves by making some kind of media soundbite gaffe that could make them look bad and be come viral, for example. They have all these things that they're trying to do to prepare for these debates. Very little of it has to do with basing arguments on good reasons.
I think your points will really resonate with listeners when they think about the candidates. Well, what about that other population that doesn't get quite the same amount of scrutiny or TV coverage? We voters. Sometimes it seems like confirmation bias leaves us so set in our ways that argumentation designed to convince anybody of anything is a waste of time. Any thoughts on the subject of we the people?
Well, I think you're right about everything you said. We get hardened, especially with repetition of the key messages. And then we have cognitive dissonance, which is this factor, because if you publicly identify with certain ideals and values, especially insofar as they deal with your identity in a deeper way, then to concede that you might be wrong about something isn't just to change your attitude towards the truth of some proposition. It's to change your attitude towards yourself about who you think you are. And so we have natural defense mechanisms against this. We look for ways of protecting our core identity because the alternative is actually quite psychologically stressful. And it's so difficult to think critically about basic beliefs that we hold dearly that if we wanted to encourage that kind of reflection that has a chance of making a change, you just can't go in and have this sort of forceful, argumentative, coercive attitude towards beliefs. You have to be much more gentle because people have to allow themselves to be really vulnerable. They have to allow themselves to really consider, what if they're wrong about this point? And what does that say about me? People don't do that in public. They do it in private. So that's where I think people can expect most of the change to happen is in sort of those private moments in between public engagements. Certainly, the rhetoric of political discourse in the U.S. right now is so heated and polarized that it's hard to imagine what that would look like because it's the opposite of that right now.
Very, very true. Well, thanks, Kevin. I know I've really appreciated your thoughts on the subject. Before you have to go, can you let listeners know what they might expect in the coming months on the Critical Thinker Academy?
Sure, thanks. Let me just make a point that connects the discussion I had earlier about the six pillars of critical thinking. The goal of the Academy actually is to provide resources in all six of those areas. Right now, I am starting with materials that I know better than others and sort of working through it. And at some point, I want to bring people on who are better schooled in the other areas to produce materials for the Academy. So that's the longer-term goal. What people should expect the next few months, there's going to be a changeover in subscription options. We're going to move to a subscription model where people can subscribe to individual modules, individual courses. We're going to be a move to having ebook versions of the individual courses as well as the online video versions. One of the things I'm planning on doing is converting all the materials I have into as many different media formats as possible to give people as much choice as possible. In terms of new material, probably the next course I'm going to work on is material on fallacies of probabilistic reasoning and reasoning about choice that springboards off of the material I've already done on probability theory.
Sounds like a lot to look forward to. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us and participating in this first Skype interview for either of us. I wish you the best of luck with all your endeavors and hope we get the chance to talk soon.
Thank you, John. It was great.
That was Kevin LaPlante from Critical Thinker Academy, and a link to his site can be found on the resources page of www.criticalvoter.com. Regarding next week's show, I'm excited to announce that we'll be hearing from another person you've heard mentioned on the podcast a number of times. So join us as Jay Heinrichs, author of Thank You for Arguing, will be here to talk about argumentation and help us handicap some of the rhetoric we've seen during the election season. But before signing off from this week's show, I have a confession that I hope will trigger some critical thought out there. Anyone with some editing experience can probably tell where I made cuts and edits in the digital audio making up the show. But most of you may not realize that little sound check audio I did with Kevin before starting the interview was actually a fake, something I cobbled together using an unused bit of an exchange we had that I cut and pasted in front of a new question recorded days after the interview actually took place. While I originally conceived of this idea as a cheap gag, I decided to actually add it once I realized that it would serve two important purposes. One educational, one rhetorical. On the educational front, this bit of time travel editing should alert you to the important media literacy lesson of never taking it on faith that what you hear on the radio or watch on TV has been sliced, diced, and rearranged before being fed up to you for consumption. And if even someone with my limited technical experience can convince you that something recorded on Friday was part of a conversation that took place the previous Wednesday, think how much more effective professionally edited news stories can be at arranging information to either reflect or distort reality. And with regard to persuasion, my soundcheck gag was not entirely innocent, but rather it served the persuasive purpose of generating sympathy and emotional response from the audience, you, as well as an ethos response of asking those of you who also struggle learning new technology to identify with me. And unlike President Obama, who had to deal with that lose-lose choice during the last debate I mentioned, the goal of my act of persuasion was to create a win-win scenario whereby you would either forgive in advance any flubs you hear in my audio or be impressed if the number of editing blunders I made was minimal. This is all part of an important persuasive technique called managing expectations, and it can be extraordinarily effective so long as you don't admit you're doing it, like I just did. Keep this in mind as the presidential campaigns begin an orgy of expectations management as we head into the next round of debates, when someone at work is trying to manage your expectations, or when you decide it's worth trying this little technique yourself. And with that, it's time to say goodbye and ask you to join me and Jay Heinrichs on the next Critical Voter Podcast.